Usually, when you try to picture what takes up the absolute most physical space in our country, your mind naturally drifts to these, grand sweeping landscapes.
Right, like endless fields of wheat stretching across the Midwest.
Exactly. Or like millions of acres of dense pine forests in these massive national parks. It's a very green, vast, open image of the American continent.
It's the classic postcard view of the country. But if you zoom in closely on our cities, our suburbs, and our commercial districts, you quickly realize there is a completely different kind of landscape dominating the terrain.
Yeah.
If you were to take every single off-street parking space in the United States, just scrape it all up and push it all together into one giant continuous slab of asphalt, it would cover an area roughly the size of the entire state of Connecticut.
Which is just, I mean, it's hard to even wrap your head around.
That is massive.
It is. Welcome to this deep dive. Today, you and I are going on a mission to explore something you probably interact with every single day of your life, but almost never think twice about, and that is parking.
We really don't think about it until we can't find a spot.
Right. And to figure out how we ended up paving over a Connecticut-sized chunk of the country, we've been synthesizing a massive stack of sources.
Yeah, we're pulling from urban planning reports from the Victoria Transport Policy Institute, environmental analyses from the ESI, legal breakdowns, and of course, Donald Shoup's groundbreaking book, The High Cost of Free Parking.
The goal here is to uncover how these seemingly arbitrary parking rules have secretly shaped our housing crisis, the environment, and, well, the very layout of the cities we live in.
Because the physical footprint alone is staggering. We're talking about millions of acres dedicated exclusively to empty vehicles.
Right.
But the landmass is just, the visual representation of the problem. The real story is how the legal requirements to build all this parking have fundamentally distorted the economy of urban spaces.
And you'd assume that to justify pouring an entire state's worth of concrete, city planners must have relied on some massive, incredibly rigorous scientific study, right, to determine exactly how much parking society actually needed.
You would hope so, but the truth is, the entire system is rooted in the post-war boom of the 1950s when car ownership was just exploding.
Right, the whole suburban boom.
Exactly. Planners at the time were genuinely terrified. They looked out at the rapid suburbanization and the massive influx of automobiles, and they just panicked. They thought street parking would become hopelessly overcrowded.
And what'd they do?
Their solution was to invent something called parking minimums. These are zoning laws that basically force developers to build a set number of off-street parking spots for literally any new commercial or residential project they construct.
Any project at all.
Pretty much. The philosophy was simple. Every new building must handle its own parking demand entirely on site.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because when you actually read the zoning codes that cities adopted back then, they aren't just general guidelines.
No, they are wildly specific.
I mean, ridiculously specific. Some city codes legally required exactly one parking space per 10 nuns in a nunnery. And in Los Angeles, planners mandated two parking spaces per hospital bed, which feels like an enormous leap of logic.
Oh, totally.
You have to wonder how many people are driving themselves to the emergency room, parking their own car, and then getting into a hospital bed.
It really doesn't make any sense. Or, consider the mandates for bowling alleys, which often required seven parking spaces per lane.
Seven spaces for one lane.
Right. That assumes every single person playing in a group drove their own separate vehicle to the alley at the exact same time.
Wow.
And what's fascinating here is the primary tool planners used to generate these numbers. It was this manual called Parking Generation, published by the Institute of Transportation Engineers, or ITE. Cities all across North America treated the statistical guidebook like an absolute Bible.
But calling standard city zoning pseudoscience, which is, Donald Shoup's primary critique in his book, that feels like a really heavy charge. You'd think the ITE had a mountain of traffic data to back up these ratios.
You really would think so, but the data behind these hyper-specific formulas was incredibly thin. Shoup's analysis revealed that half of the parking generation rates in that manual were based on four or fewer actual observations.
Wait, four observations? For the whole country?
Just four. And even more shocking, 22% of those rates were based on a single study.
You're kidding.
I'm not. And the methodology was deeply flawed, too. They would typically observe a suburban location at peak hours. These were locations where parking was completely free and where absolutely no public transit was available.
So they looked at a suburban office park where driving was literally the only option to get there.
Exactly.
And where parking cost the driver absolutely nothing and they just counted the cars.
That was the science.
Relying on this manual to mandate city rate parking is like throwing a free pizza party in the suburbs, seeing that everyone eats five slices because it's free, and then legally mandating that every restaurant in the country must bake five pizzas per customer, just in case.
That is the perfect analogy. And because developers were legally bound to those flawed formulas, they ended up building massive, sprawling lots to satisfy the legal requirement rather than, you know, responding to actual market demand.
Right.
It created a colossal oversupply.
Right.
We essentially overprescribed parking for decades. But the critical part of this equation is that just because a parking spot is free for the driver when they pull into a grocery store or an apartment complex, it absolutely does not mean the space was free to build.
Right, because asphalt, concrete, excavation equipment, none of that is cheap.
Not at all.
The financial toll of this is just staggering. When you look at the numbers from the Victoria Transport Policy Institute, you realize parking spaces cost more to build than some actual cars.
Oh, easily.
They note that constructing a single structured parking space costs between $2,000 and $20,000 on average.
And that's just the average.
Right. And if a developer is building in a dense urban environment where they are forced to dig underground to meet their parking minimums, the costs just skyrocket. In cities like Los Angeles, a single underground parking spot can soar to $56,000.
That is $56,000 for a blank rectangle of concrete.
Insane.
And the developer absorbs that massive upfront cost, but they obviously don't just eat the loss, right? They pass those costs directly on to the renters and the homebuyers. The parking minimum essentially forces the developer to bundle the cost of housing a car into the cost of housing a human.
And the VTPI statistics show that this bundled parking can raise apartment rents by 17%.
17% just for parking.
So picture a lower-income, car-free household living in a two-bedroom apartment. They might be overpaying by $300 a month for unneeded spaces.
That they don't even use.
Exactly. It functions as an invisible 10% income tax to subsidize their car-owning neighbors.
And the spatial cost is just as alarming as the financial cost. Two parking spaces, plus the wide access lanes required to maneuver a vehicle into them, take up roughly the same square footage as an entire micro-apartment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We are quite literally choosing to dedicate prime real estate to housing cars instead of housing people.
Which brings us to the environmental toll.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the environmental and urban sprawl impacts are severe. When zoning laws mandate vast surface lots, it drastically reduces the overall density of a city.
Right. Everything gets spread out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The geometry sprawl means every destination is pushed further apart. A grocery store is separated from a neighborhood by a sea of parking, making it much harder and more dangerous to walk or take transit.
And that lack of walkability, ironically, forces people to drive more.
Which then requires even more parking. It's a vicious cycle.
And all that pavement creates urban heat islands. The asphalt absorbs the sun's energy all day and radiates it back out, raising local temperatures significantly.
It's a huge issue in cities right now.
Plus, it completely destroys natural drainage. When it rains, the water can't absorb into the ground. Instead, it hits the impermeable asphalt, collects motor oil, heavy metals, and tire microplastics, and flushes straight into the municipal water system as highly polluted stormwater runoff.
Which is terrible for the local ecosystem.
So when you lay out all these hidden costs, the fact that parking minimums constrain our housing supply, drive up our monthly rent by hundreds of dollars, and severely pollute our water, the obvious solution seems to be just removing the minimums, right?
It seems obvious.
Just let developers build housing without the mandatory parking lots. But the research shows that as soon as developers actually try to build higher density infill in cities, which is taking an empty lot and replacing it with an apartment building, it triggers intense political and community warfare.
The conflict is intense. And it brings up the classic battle between the YMBYs and the NMBYs. The WinMBYs, or Yes in My Backyard advocates, generally push for deregulation, more housing density, and an immediate end to parking minimums. On the other side, the MMBYs, or Not in My Backyard groups, push back against this development.
And when you dig into the political dynamics surrounding this, the resistance to new housing comes from all across the political spectrum.
It really does.
You've got conservative forces wanting to protect incumbent advantages and preserve the look of a neighborhood. And then you've got leftist groups deeply distrustful of corporate developers coming in to make a profit. And we're not endorsing either side here. We're just reporting what the sources highlight about this debate.
Exactly. It's important to look at all of the different motivations, because the common YMB caricature of a NIMBY, you know, image of a wealthy older homeowner in a leafy suburb fighting development purely to protect their property values and exclusionary status quo, that's only part of the story.
Right.
The data points to a completely different group driving resistance in urban centers. An article we reviewed from Vital City by Freddie DeBoer highlights this exact phenomenon. He focuses on the misunderstood urban NIMBY.
The misunderstood urban NIMBY.
When you look at dense urban cores, places like Boyle Heights in L.A. or Crown Heights in Brooklyn, the fierce resistance to new development often doesn't come from wealthy homeowners at all.
Who is it coming from, then?
It comes directly from working-class renters, often people of color, who do not own the property they live in.
But wait, if the Victoria Transport Policy Institute says more development and fewer parking minimums lowers housing costs overall, aren't these urban renters shooting themselves in the foot by opposing new buildings?
It's a great question. On a macroeconomic level, building more supply eventually lowers average costs. But human beings live on a microeconomic level. Because supply follows demand and construction is expensive, developers rarely build affordable housing in disinvested neighborhoods first.
Right, they build luxury housing.
Exactly, because that is where the profit margins are highest. So while thousands of new units might help stabilize citywide prices eventually, locally, right on that specific block, a brand new luxury building raises the immediate neighborhood average rent.
Ah, so the local landlords see a shiny new mid-rise building go up next door. They notice the neighborhood is suddenly attracting a wealthier demographic, and they raise their own rents.
Precisely. The local bodegas and laundromats might get priced out and replaced by expensive cafes. These urban NMBYs aren't fighting to protect a scenic view. They are fighting legitimate fears of gentrification, displacement, and the total loss of their community fabric.
That makes total sense. To a working-class renter, the new luxury building isn't a solution. It's a direct threat.
And this fierce local resistance often centers directly around the curb. The fear is that if the city removes parking minimums and developers build a dense apartment building without providing a massive concrete garage, all those new residents will just flood the neighborhood and overwhelm the street parking.
Which is a very rational fear if you rely on a car to get to work. And this brings us to the ultimate question. If we stop forcing developers to build giant parking lots, how do we handle the chaos at the curb?
It's the million-dollar question.
Because we've all experienced this. You're driving to a restaurant or you're just trying to get home, and you find yourself endlessly circling the block to find a free street parking spot over and over.
Just hovering, waiting for someone to pull out.
Exactly. Donald Shoup's research has a specific term for this phenomenon. He calls it cruising. And the data shows that cruising makes up 8% of total city traffic.
8%. It sounds like a minor annoyance until you look at the actual data. Shoup shared a mind-blowing study in Westwood Village, which is a busy commercial district near UCLA.
Right.
He and his researchers tracked drivers and found that the average time it took to find a free curb spot was only 3.3 minutes.
Which feels like nothing.
Right. 3 minutes is barely one song on the radio. But Shoup multiplied that 3.3 minutes by all the drivers doing it every single day in that one specific district.
Oh, boy.
Cumulatively, it created 3,600 extra vehicle miles traveled per day. Over a single year, in just Westwood Village alone, it equaled 2 round trips to the moon.
2 round trips to the moon, just from people looking for parking.
Yep. And it generated 728 tons of CO2 every single year.
Here's where it gets really interesting. People will pack city council meetings to fight for their free street parking. But it's a classic tragedy of the commons.
Completely.
Underpricing street parking means everyone acts in their own short-term interest to grab the free resource, which means everyone collectively suffers through the resulting gridlock, the wasted time, and the pollution. The traffic and smog it causes are actually far worse than just paying a few bucks for a spot.
Shoup recognizes this behavioral trap, which is why he proposes a very elegant set of market-based reforms.
What does he suggest?
First, he argues that cities should charge fair market prices for curb parking. The idea is to adjust the meter price dynamically so that one or two spots on every single block are always open. If a block is full, the price goes up. If it's empty, the price comes down.
The immediate problem there is political, though. If a city simply raises meter prices, local residents and small business owners will revolt.
Absolutely. No one wants to pay to park in front of their own apartment.
Right. And businesses fear that paid parking will drive their customers away.
Which is why the second half of Shoup's reform is so vital. He suggests establishing parking benefit districts.
Okay, how does that work?
Normally, when you put coins in a meter, that revenue disappears into a massive citywide general fund. You never see it again. But with a parking benefit district, the city takes that meter revenue and legally dedicates it to improving the exact neighborhood where it was collected.
Oh, that changes the psychology entirely. Instead of seeing meters as a penalty, they see it as a dedicated funding stream for their own block.
Exactly. The sources highlight Old Pasadena as the prime example. It was a dying commercial district. They instituted a parking benefit district, and suddenly, the meter money was staying right there on the street.
What did they do with the money?
They used it to steam clean the sidewalks, plant beautiful street trees, and improve lighting. By charging a fair price and keeping the money local, they transformed Old Pasadena into a highly vibrant, wealthy commercial area.
This raises an important question. Wait, actually, you usually say that?
I do. This raises an important question about how municipal control and property rights can ultimately balance.
There it is.
By unbundling parking costs from rent and charging fairly for the street, residents get what they pay for and pay for what they get. It restores market efficiency and social equity.
It's a profound lever of urban design. It dictates how much our homes cost, how polluted our air is, and who gets to live in our most vibrant neighborhoods. But the tide is turning. Several states, like Oregon, California, and Colorado, are finally passing laws to eliminate these post-war parking mandates near public transit.
It's the beginning of undoing a 70-year-old mistake.
It really is. As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder. The sources mentioned that shared parking and mobility as a service are reducing our need to own multiple cars.
Right.
But look further down the road. As self-driving technology and ride-sharing potentially make personal car ownership obsolete in the future, what will happen to that Connecticut-sized mass of asphalt currently blanketing our country?
The demand for stationary parking could just plummet.
Imagine the possibilities if millions of acres of prime real estate are suddenly freed up. Could the end of the parking lot be the beginning of a massive urban renaissance? Something to think about the next time you're circling the block.